Hey, hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of RetroTube, the show where two best friends chat about their favourite television shows of yesteryear. And, yap jokes notwithstanding, usually make it to the end of an episode relatively unscathed. This week is partially broadcast from the new RetroTube Northern HQ in deepest, darkest Cheshire, where it's my turn again to share a television show. And I'm staying in America and turning to the world of 60s sitcoms for my absolute favourite television show of all. It's The Monkees.
Here we come, walk down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. And people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
The Monkees ran for 58 episodes over two seasons from 1966 to 1968 and followed the adventures of a fictional struggling rock and roll band who in reality proved so popular in the States that they even outsold the Beatles at one point. Their breakout third album, Headquarters, spent the entire summer of 1967 at number 2 on the Billboard album charts, right behind a little remembered album entitled Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The television series was equally popular and even garnered them an Emmy. We are both massive fans of the Monkees' music here at RetroTube, and in fact, the first time we actually met was when you came to stay with me to go to see a Michael Nesmith solo gig, which I would like to also call it the greatest night of my life. But Adam, what do you know about the Monkees' television series? Were you nearly as obsessed with it as a kid as I am now, or were you normal? And what did you think of the episodes that we saw today?
Normal is relative, I think.
I think so. I think so, but I do also think that sometimes I take the biscuit.
Quite potentially. So this is a slightly different one from normal because, as you say, I'm already a massive Monkees fan of the music. Certainly, I haven't watched the TV show since the early 90s when it was last shown, and I know that in Monkees fandom circles that there are people that are quite contemptuous of the likes of me that feel that if you're a proper Monkees fan, you should embrace and consume the whole Monkees oeuvre as one glorious, joyous whole. But
You don't.
I don't. I have all the Monkees albums apart from, I don't have Pool It, Justice, or the recent Christmas Party one, which I couldn't even...
Yeah, we don't talk about that one.
No. I have Good Times, so I'm dedicated, and I think I have all the 70s Michael Nesmith albums as well. Yeah, I'm fairly hardcore, and as everyone knows by now, and as I'm very tediously prone to saying, their movie Head is in my top 5 favourite films of all time.
It certainly is one that we go to a lot.
It really is, yes. And I think I liken it a bit to, in the late 80s, at a garden fete in the village where I lived, I bought an enormous box of science fiction paperbacks, old ones from the 50s and 60s, and I just consumed these books. I read loads of them, and I started off with the Isaac Asimov and the Arthur C. Clarke ones because those are the two names that I knew. I loved 2001 A Space Odyssey movie, so I read all those books. And then when I got to the Philip K. Dick books, who was a name I didn't really know before, and I read his weird, trippy, mind-bending books, I couldn't then go back to the more straightforward, straight sci-fi Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov books. And I think that's similar to my relationship with the Monkees film and the Monkees TV series, that having experienced Head, having watched Head...
Wow. Sorry. It's fine, I'm good.
Having watched Head and taken it to heart as this amazing and almost life-changing film, I couldn't really go back to watching the TV series. And when it was repeated in the early 90s, I just couldn't really engage with it. I found it just a bit too lightweight compared to the film. It was shown on the BBC, I think, in Saturday mornings during the early 80s, so you'd get either the Monkees or Banana Split. So it's a similar sort of Technicolor, zany, mid-60s American show involving a fictitious band. So I grew up with that. And also around the same time that, as reported in the last episode about Magical Mystery Tour, we picked up a copy of Sgt. Pepper's from my gran's house, my uncle had a cassette of the Monkees, the blue compilation cassette, which is probably just called Greatest Hits or something like that. So we used to drive around Scotland listening to that in the car. So that was the second band I got into after the Beatles was the Monkees, and I probably would have recognised some of the songs from the TV show.
Yeah.
I almost see it as two separate things. So there's the Monkees TV show that happens to star the members of one of my favourite bands, but the two don't really meet in my head, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, because even though I got into the music and the television show at the same time, and they are kind of inextricably linked in a way, I do kind of view them as two separate beasts, because essentially the television show is about a fictional band, and the idea of releasing the songs originally was just simply a nice bonus, that, you know, they get more revenue from the music, and that would probably make people want a second series. That was all that it was. But they didn't realise at the time, nobody realised how big it was going to be. They thought it was just going to be another run-of-the-mill 60s sitcom. When they released Last Train to Clarksville, because they released Last Train to Clarksville a couple of weeks before the series aired in September 1966, it just blew, it just exploded, and it became this whole other beast, it became this whole other thing. Nobody expected it, nobody had any idea that it would be nearly as popular as it was.
It was like Leonard Nimoy becoming a real Vulcan.
It was exactly like Leonard Nimoy.
Somebody really should use that Vulcan analogy, actually. That's quite a
somebody
good analogy.
Should.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody ever has that.
No.
Yeah, I'm proud of you for that.
Oh, yeah, me thinking of that, I think that was really clever.
Nobody guessed that this was going to happen. So, to everybody who was involved in the Monkees at the time, it was just a TV show. That was all that it was. And then the music thing was a whole separate entity that, you know, came to life in its own and became its own separate beast because of the legal ramifications of, you know, the Monkees getting out of their contract with Don Kirshner and Screen Gems. Just that whole thing and what it meant for music and for rock and roll and for the entire music industry. It was just such a huge, huge thing that it has to be used as a completely different thing to the show.
Yes, and I think also texturally they're very different.
They are.
Because I think one of the cleverest things they did was to not do comedy songs. So it's a comedy show, very overtly. It's beyond comedy into like just outright zaniness. But the songs are straight pop songs, by and large. There's a few silly ones.
Well, I'm going to buy me a dog.
I'm going to buy me a dog and Auntie Griselda and a few of those other ones. But by and large, they would fit alongside listening to Loving Spoonful songs or...
Absolutely, and they weren't just silly throwaway things. I mean, they got Jerry Goffin and Carole King, they got Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, they got Jeff Barry,
Neil Diamond, Harry Nilsson.
They got so many of the biggest, most high quality songwriters. This wasn't a tiny, tiny project. It was a proper thing.
I think what's also clever about this is because it is obviously very overtly a cash in on A Hard Day's Night. That was the original intention. It's like, oh, this, you know, these Beatles, and they've made this wacky comedy film. Can we do that? Can we make that? But to do it and do a TV show and have our own band and maybe put the Loving Spoonful into it or the Turtles or something like that. But I think what is really clever is that they haven't done cod Beatle music.
No.
So they're not trying to sound like the Beatles and they're not really trying to be like the Beatles. It's not really anything like A Hard Day's Night at all, apart from all the musical sequences are basically Can't Buy Me Love in terms of them running about at high speed in a field. but it's a very American sound. It's not them trying to do British pop and putting on like a Liverpudlian drawl and trying to do all the production techniques and harmonies and that kind of thing. It is very definitely their own thing. It's the Monkey sound and it's unique to them. So that's good. Yeah, that works. I think that's what's kept it a thing that people still watch and listen to today.
Yeah. And I think it was also a very cleverly written show in that it purposely didn't have any kind of satire. The episodes could, I mean, although technologies and everything have obviously moved on since the 1960s, the scenarios do still work in every episode.
Pretty much, yeah.
You can put the monkeys on and show an episode of the monkeys today to a random child, and the child will laugh at the funny bits that they're supposed to laugh at because it's just funny.
No, I mean, there is sort of genre, there's genre spoofing and pastichery, I suppose, going on. So if you don't know gangster films, or you don't know westerns or that kind of thing, you might not pick up on all the references. But generally, it's so broad. You can just enjoy the larking.
There is an awful lot of larking.
There's certainly
and
a lot
even
of
if
larking.
You, even if you don't get sort of the westerns and the mobsters and the... You'll laugh at the funny voices. There's enough personality, there's enough chemistry between the four lead actors for it to have run. And I think, going back to the music, I think the music was a very large part of the reason that it only ran for two series.
Before they assembled a band, especially for it, they did think about piloting in an already formed band. And as far as I know, the Loving Spoonful was top of the list. And I think that could have worked, but then we would have only have had one of the band. But now we've got both the Loving Spoonful and the Monkees.
I know, isn't that wonderful?
But I was thinking about it the other night that the personalities, I think, would have fit. So you get John Sebastian, who is the sensitive singer-songwriter, so he would have been like the more Mike Nesmith, serious one, and then Steve Boone, who's kind of, he'd be the dumb one. And Joe Butler, the drummer, he's quite tall, but he'd be the pretty one. And Zal Yanofsky was very definitely in life and always the zany one.
Yeah.
To an almost Keith Moon degree, by all accounts.
Nobody was that level.
He wasn't quite as bad, but he was close. He was sort of a 9 on the Keith Moon level, I think, on the Keith Moon scale.
Yeah.
I'm glad we got the Monkees, because then we can enjoy Monkee Records and we can enjoy Loving Spoonful Records as well, and people take the Loving Spoonful maybe a bit more seriously than they take the Monkees.
I think it's quite unfair that the Monkees weren't taken as seriously as a band for the reasons that I've already said, like the things that they did, the fight that they had to make their own music, to record using their own instruments, despite the fact that, by their own admissions, none of them were the best musicians in the world ever. I think that the stand that they took was pretty damn punk rock of them.
I think so, yeah.
And they really deserved an awful lot more respect than they ever got for it, because they paved the way for so many other bands to have more creative control, and they paved the way for bands to have that as an automatic right, not something that they too needed to fight for. You know, as well as I do, that I could go on for 1,000 years. About how much
and you
I
may
love.
Well.
I may well. I think, honestly, all my love that I've had for these guys since the age of 12 when I discovered them, I think it's all warranted, because the things they did changed so many things. They are literally the precursors to MTV and the MTV generation, not least of all because Michael Nesmith developed it.
MTV and Liquid Paper is quite a legacy.
Yeah, quite. indeed. They did have a script every week, but it was pretty much just an outline, and they let the boys just go for it. And they did, and they kept most of the improv in, which was great. I think in the second series they kind of went a little wild with that, because I think in the first series it was more a standard sort of, we've used this kind of a plot in this other sitcom, it's fine, we can recycle it and put it in this. A lot of them were quite standard. Like, they had writers like Gerald Gardner and Dee Caruso, who were writers on things like Get Smart and other spy comedy shows like that. But they had a great pool of already well-known, well-established writers to work with.
Mm.
I just think that from sort of the time that the Monkees television show came and the amount of things that they changed, and they didn't even know really at the time that they themselves were changing anything, but the way that things were done has changed from the Monkees. And I think that televisually and musically and even culturally, I think the world owes an awful lot to the Monkees, and that's that. They are my boys.
They're your boys.
They are my Beatles. I've always said that the Monkees yes. are my Beatles.
Although you say sort of they admit they weren't the greatest musicians in the world. I think they're all very musically talented anyway, though. So even if they weren't necessarily virtuosos, lots of people weren't. I mean, most of the Beatles weren't really virtuosos, but I think that all four of them were dripping in musicality. Mm. And it, you know, even Davy Jones, who couldn't really necessarily play anything beyond percussion, he was still a good, reliable, solid song and dance man. So that's, I think, a very underrated musical skill to have anyway, and to bring to the mixture. And Peter was a very talented keyboard player. Mickey with his singing, singer-songwriter. And Mike Nesmith as well, I think, sort of one of my biggest influences as a songwriter as well. Even though, like, the Beatles are my top guys. In fact, the Beatles are my monkeys, essentially.
Yes.
As songwriters, they're slightly daunting. Mm. To keep up with. So it's kind of Mike Nesmith's songs that... Mike Nesmith and Neil Innes are sort of probably my two main songwriting inspirations, I would say.
Oh, I think that's lovely.
Three of them really were proper singer-songwriters, and Davy Jones contributed to songwriting as well. And a couple of their albums, they played most of the instruments on as well, so it's not like they couldn't. They did a pretty good job. So, yeah, the idea that they didn't play on any of their albums is a bit of a myth, really, isn't it?
It is. They certainly didn't play on the first record.
Because they weren't even formed. Well, that was all recorded before they'd even established the band, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Peter Tork turned up one day to record, and he brought his bass with him. Mm. The chap at the control desk said, what did you bring that for? We're not going to be needing you today, pal.
Which would be crushing.
Yeah, it was. And I think Peter and Mike thought it was going to be a more music-heavy show than it was.
Yeah.
I think Mickey and Davey, because they'd been child actors.
They were more showbiz savvy.
They knew what was going on, really. And they knew it was like, you know, turn up, stand where the X is, say your lines, go home. Mm. They were quite prepared for that. But I think Peter and Mike expected a lot more. And eventually they did get it, which was amazing, really.
And, Headquarters was a huge smash album, and they played most of the instruments on that, I think, apart from bass, which was their producer, Chip, who was player from the Turtles. So he was an experienced musician.
After they'd recorded Headquarters, because they had made this gigantic fuss about playing their own instruments,
yes.
And they went in to record it. And normally for albums like that, the session musicians will go in and they do the album in maybe two or three takes. The Monkees were doing 30, 40 takes.
So they're essentially making Sgt. Pepper. Spending like months doing the one album, yeah.
But they were so determined to play every single goddamn flipping note.
Yes.
On that goddamn album. Apart from, they didn't play the French horns in Shades of Grey.
And they didn't play the bass.
I think that was pretty much it.
Wow.
Everything else was 100% them.
And then by the time you get to the later albums, Birds, the Bees and Monkees and Head, it's back to session musicians, but I think it's them choosing the session musicians, so it's much more them in control. And like, we'll get our guys in, we'll get Neil Young and Steve Stills and Eddie Ho and Lance Wakely and all those people. And I think it's the control of it. Like, if you're just going in and everyone else is doing all the stuff, and it's like, well, what's the point of me? But if you're essentially acting as musical coordinator yourself, as one of the band, then at least that's a modicum of control, isn't it? And you can get in Steve Stills to do the lead guitar because he's your legitimate music mate.
None of this is the television show.
Yes, we watched three episodes of the first series.
We watched three episodes of season one because series one and series two are very, very different. Monkey See, Monkey Die, Captain Crocodile and Monkeys in a Ghost Town. What did you think about the episodes in general?
I think it's really fun to watch the monkeys in action. And it's fun to watch their chemistry, and it's a nice time capsule of TV and the era and TV changing and that kind of thing. Which is my tactful way of saying it's probably not my sense of humour.
Right.
It's maybe a little bit zany for my tastes. So it was fun to watch, but it was rare that I actually laughed.
I see.
And I found it a little... This will make me sound really old. I found it a little bit tiring to watch.
Oh, Adam.
I needed to go for my lie down afterwards. I needed to put my slippers and my shawl on.
Oh, honey. It's been nice knowing you for the last 12 years, but this is it.
I mean, I must admit, as with most of these things, there are episodes that I enjoyed more than others.
Right.
Of the three we watched.
That's fair play.
Yeah.
Because they were all very, very different.
They were quite different, yeah. So the first one we watched was Monkey See, Monkey Die, which is about the monkeys find out, after nearly getting evicted by their landlord, that they have randomly inherited a mansion from a millionaire who they met briefly once when they accidentally returned somebody else's wallet to him, and he was so grateful at being given somebody else's wallet that he bequeathed them his mansion.
No, he didn't.
Or didn't he? What did he bequeath them?
The library organ.
Oh, is it just the organ? I found it a bit difficult to keep...
It was just the
keep
organ.
Keep track of, right? Okay, I was a bit confused.
It wasn't the whole house.
I'm very old.
You're
it
very old.
It was all very confusing. They talk so quickly.
Sorry. Oh.
That makes sense then, because I couldn't really understand why. I thought they'd gone to...
They ended up going home. No, they didn't get the mansion.
Right, okay.
Hashtag the girl in it.
Yes.
Which we'll come to in a second.
I really like the production design, particularly of their house.
Mm.
It's very beautiful to look at. And, of course, their monkey house features in Head. There aren't many carryovers from the TV show into Head itself. Mike doesn't wear his hat. And
no.
There aren't, the monkey-mobile isn't in it. And there's sort of barely any references. But their monkey apartment appears. So I'm used to it from the film. So it's a little bit strange seeing it also in the TV series in a much more lightweight and wacky environment. There's lots of little details to see and little notices everywhere. And there's like a big stone head outside the door or something like that. A big kind of Grecian head.
Yeah, and I also like that there's a big sign saying keep off the grass, which obviously has nothing to do with the...
Yes, being subversive even then.
Yes.
So they end up going to this mansion with various other people to hear the reading of the will, where they're going to be granted an organ.
Yes.
So there's a fog and they have to stay there overnight, and it turns into a sort of haunted house murder mystery where the guests are apparently killed off one by one, a bit like the Harry Nilsson song Who Done It. So the monkeys decide to try and solve this mystery of who's doing the killing.
That's right.
It's essentially the story.
So yeah, they turn up at Cunningham Manor and they are greeted by the English butler Ralph,
who looked a lot like Will Self.
Very much. He did. The place was quite creepy, and yeah, I love the fact that they turned up in their stage clothes. They do tend to go everywhere in their stage clothes
they
for no apparent reason. Maybe they just don't have any other clothes. They've got like three... They've got the same shirt in like three or four different colours.
Like Formula One drivers do everything in their race overalls.
Yeah, that's it. They all turn up in their stage clothes. They think that they're only going to inherit and run, but somehow they manage to have brought their pyjamas with them. I mean, just in case, I don't know.
Just in case, yeah, just in case Davy falls in love with the cute girl of the week.
That's right, which he does this week.
In fact, this is the only one of the three we watched that actually does have Davy getting stars in his eyes.
Actually, that's right.
I wrote down the lines that I liked. There's also three adults, as well as the monkeys and the Davy Jones crush girl,
yeah.
Ellie. There's also the three adults, one of whom is a palm reader.
Yes, Madame Roselle.
So the line is, "Want to read my palm?"
No, I will. They make it into a movie.
Yeah.
I like that line.
I like that line. Harris Kingsley, who has written a few books about travelling Beverly Hills on £5 a day. South Dakota, fact or fiction.
Yes.
All kinds of crazy titles like that, which are really funny. But he's so pushy with everybody, trying to find out
yes.
whether they've read any of the books that nobody's ever heard of.
It's like me with this podcast.
It is exactly. It's like both of us with our podcast. Oh. My favourite bit during all of the introductions is when they finally get down to listening to the will. John Cunningham, who is the eccentric millionaire who's left them this library organ, he's recorded his will on a phonograph, and it starts off with, "I'm sorry I can't be with you, but I'm dead." And well, what can I say except,
"Wish you were here."
And honestly, I want "Wish you were here" on my gravestone. It always makes me giggle every single time.
We have Davy falling in love with Ellie, who is played by Stacey Gregg. She's an English actress, and she's probably most known over here. She did the voice of Vixen in Animals of Farthing Wood.
Yes.
But she was actually in it less than I expected, because my memory of these things, and like I say, it's been 30 years since I last watched The Monkees.
It's been 24 years.
30 years ago. Back when all this was just fields.
Usually the girl is the main guest character.
Yes.
And the monkeys are there to help her. And in fact, they are there to help her in this case because she is set to inherit the entire mansion and the grown-ups are generally getting a lot less than that and they're not happy about it, really. But she's getting the main bulk of the inheritance, but only if she stays overnight in the haunted house. So it's quite a sort of standard setup, really. So they are sort of ostensibly on her side, but she's not really in it as much as some of the others. She doesn't really team up with them.
No,
in the
she's
same
not.
Way.
And she doesn't even have very many lines. She just
sort
of stands there and smiles.
So it's a very nominal falling in love this week. There isn't actually much connection between Davy and Ellie.
No.
They don't really share much screen time or anything like that.
The falling in love is great for the gag that Mickey and Mike share.
Davy!
Davy?
Look, statistics prove that 2 out of 3 teenage marriages end in divorce.
3 out of 3.
Four out of 3.
He's in love.
Yeah, for the very first time today.
I remember making, because I have a niece and 2 nephews, and they aren't a great deal younger than me, because my brother is 19 years older than me. So my relationship with my niece and my nephews is more as though they're my little sister and brothers. Because I got into the monkeys when I was like 12, I forced all 3 of them into sitting and watching. I forced them into getting into the monkeys and the Who. Anything after that, they're kind of on their own, but I do insist on those.
Right, okay. That's fair enough. That's quite disparate bands, really, apart from the fact that they're very amusing people.
Yeah.
Quite disparate.
And they're both my favourites. I always say that the monkeys are my heart, but the Who are my soul.
Right, okay.
Which I think describes me. So, yeah, I remember watching this episode with my nephew Tom, my eldest nephew. When it got to that bit, he was just weeping, laughing pretty much the whole way through.
Oh, really?
And I think he, at the time, must have only been about maybe 8 or 9.
That's a good age for it. That's
it. It is a really good age for it. And there's a gag later on, and every time I see it, all I can hear is Tom laughing. And he...
Go on, what's the gag?
He properly went like me with the yak. It was like that. And it was that level of giggling and Motley style breathing. But it's a little bit later on in this episode where Mike is trying to get help and he tries to summon a carrier pigeon. A carrier pigeon arrives and there's already a message attached to its leg and it says,
"Please don't strap a message to my leg. I am not a carrier pigeon."
That's one of the ones I wrote down.
And then later on, like the follow-up gag, he finds a load of bones in a closet, which I think is a really, really funny gag that nobody really picks up on.
Right, skeleton in the closet. Right, of course. Yeah, no, I didn't pick up on that.
Honestly.
I'm just a bit hungry.
Well, fair enough. And he tries to attract a Saint Bernard. And the Saint Bernard comes up and he's like, "Oh, there's already a message around its neck." The message is,
"There is a message for you on the pigeon."
And that gag just set our poor Tom off.
Poor Tom.
But every time I watch it, I can just see in my mind's eye him absolutely, completely losing it. And like, he properly went bright red and could hardly breathe. He was laughing that much, and it always just, it's just so full of joy. This particular episode, it always makes me think of our Tom.
Oh.
I know. I'm a sentimental old sod.
I think this is the thing. I think that's the perfect age for it, and I'm not that age, which is possibly why a lot of the jokes didn't really land with me so much, that it is a children's show.
Yes, it is.
It's not even really a family show, it's a children's show.
It pretty much is, yeah.
The one joke I did actually laugh out loud at in this episode, though, was when they hear a scream and one of them says, "What was that?" "Oh, C sharp." So, I think it would be unfair of me to criticise it for not entertaining a 46-year-old when it's intended to entertain 9-year-olds.
Yeah. I mean, it still entertains me, but I kind of didn't really... I've not really advanced yet. I'll take after my dad.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to criticise something for being successful in what it sets out to do. And the fact that kids nowadays can still watch it and be really entertained by it, and I'm sure those that see it of that age really, really enjoy it.
It's why silent comedy still works, because people falling off stuff is funny. If that's the way that your sense of humour is wired, you're going to laugh at it.
Exactly. And the monkeys are essentially playing children.
They are.
In their relationship with the adult world. So it is, they call them kids and they're playing characters who are in presumably their late teens or early 20s. They would have all been in their early 20s at the time. But the way they act and the way they relate to the world is more like 8 or 9 year olds. And so it's almost like Big, the Tom Hanks film, where he's an 8 year old that goes into a grown up's body. It's like four versions of Big and they're all released into this adult world. And the adults are quite silly. They're all played by comedy actors. So they're not, it's not like Frank Spencer, Mr. Spencer, please. It's not like a super straight adult world where everyone's really gruff and serious. They're quite daft characters as well.
No, because the adults in this, especially Madame Roselle, is bonkers.
Yes. But they're still representing that adult world of authority and rules and that kind of thing, and petty ego and petty conflicts and conniving and manipulation. So you've got these four innocents who are just zany and will just lark about and go, bah, 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 or dress up in a, you know, put on a moustache and pretend to be an old man for the sake of pulling the wool over somebody's eyes or that kind of thing. So they're very much sort of doing the kind of things that children wish they could do to their parents and teachers. And when the monkeys do it, they win. It works. None of the adults say, but you're Mike Nesmith, you're just wearing a grey moustache. They do believe that he's an actual old janitor.
Absolutely.
The whole thing is completely tailored to that age group. And then you also have the slightly older teenage girls who can buy the music and swoon at how pretty they are.
Yes, because they are very pretty. They have lovely hair.
Lovely hair. And they seem like very nice young men.
And they've got incredible trousers.
They don't have the incredible shirts quite yet, but I think in the second series we'll see more of those.
Yes. The boys are trying to figure out what's going on with all of these people disappearing and, you know, being murdered and stuff. So they ask Madame Roselle what she thinks they should do. And obviously, Madame Roselle suggests a séance.
Of all the grown-up characters, I think she's the most entertaining.
She is, definitely.
She has some nice asides.
When the murders start happening, she just goes up to Ellie and goes, "Young lady, I wouldn't be in your shoes for anything. This place is full of nothing but evil." And then just wanders off.
I just had a vision about the butler. Either he's going to take a long, pleasant journey and enjoy good fortune, or he's dead.
Which is it?
6 of 1, 6 of 1 or the other.
I think you can kind of tell the older actors who get it and those who don't.
Yeah.
I think there was a bit of friction sometimes with the sort of more old school actors who didn't really appreciate the improvising and the larking around and how freeform it all was. And so presumably some of them got it and could go along with it a bit, and others are a bit more old school showbiz who are a bit more uptight about that sort of thing.
Very much so. The monkeys were quite Marmite to the guests.
Yes.
As I'm sure you can imagine.
She was one of the ones who could go along with it a bit more. Yeah, got it and could play along with it.
There was something a little bit Ethel Merman about her. And Ethel Merman was always up for a good giggle.
I saw the monkeys live in 1997, the only classic four-piece intact I've ever seen. I think that Davey did his Ethel Merman on that occasion, if I remember correctly. I know he did it on telly, but I think he probably did it on that gig as well.
What's his Ethel Merman?
It's basically Davy Jones in drag.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he loved doing that.
So I think he did it on that occasion. It's a long time ago now, but it was a very good concert. It's very strange, sort of, like I say, it's the only time I've seen one of those classic bands intact and kind of squinting your eyes going, that's all of the monkeys.
Yeah.
I'd seen the Hollies, I'd seen the Kinks, I'd seen Paul McCartney and his band, I'd seen a few of the others, but it was always pieces of the band. It wasn't the original band from the time. It was elements of the band with other musicians in there.
Yeah.
So this was the first time, wow, it's actually them in front of me. I'm in the same room as the actual monkeys.
I know. I'm so, so jealous of that, because 97 was when you went to see them, but 96 was the year that I discovered them.
Yeah.
I think it's my 25th anniversary this year of Monkeys fandom.
Wow.
I know, it's a quarter of a century. Do I get a gold clock for this, or... I really, really wanted to go and see them, but I wasn't allowed.
Oh.
I know. I was gutted.
We got an upgrade. I went with my friend Sam, and we had quite bad tickets, but there was some ticket tout on the door. who was offering, like, an upgrade for a reasonably small amount of money, and Sam, who's a bit more forward about these things, was like, yeah, all right, yeah, let's do it, come on. I was like, all right, then. So we gave him this bit of extra money, and me being as anxious and nervous as I am, I got these new tickets, I thought, we've blown it, we've ruined it. He's got our old tickets, and we've got probably some forgeries, and we're going to get turned away. My one chance to see the Monkees, we've come all this way to London.
Aww.
So I was worrying, I was fretting the whole rest of the time in the queue.
Oh, no.
But it was fine. We got in and we were really close to the front. We were right on the main stalls.
Wow.
I can't remember how many rows from the front because it was 24 years ago now. But it was a really good show. And the first song they did was Circle Sky. And I think Sam and I were probably the only people there who knew the song. We were like, Circle Sky, yes. And all the rest of the crowd were like, huh? Reggae?
Mm-hmm. When I went to see them in 2011... Yes, it will have been 2011, because it was Davey's last tour. I went to see him in Liverpool. I was genuinely the only person who knew all of the words to all of the songs. Yeah. Because they'd started doing this amazing thing where they were playing, like, really, really obscure tracks.
Oh, brilliant.
The intro started to one song, and I was like, God, this sounds just like Hard to Believe. You won't be playing Hard to Believe at a Monkees concert. Nobody knows that. That's an album track.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, Davey's like, it's Hard to Believe. And I was like, what? It was great. They were even playing, like, you know, tracks that were bonus tracks on the CD reissues that hadn't made the cut of the original album.
Blimey.
Like I Don't Think You Know Me. Like, they were playing that level of obscure.
Oh, I love that song. That's one of my favourites.
They sang every single song from head.
Yeah, I think they did when I saw them, pretty much.
It was just amazing.
I know they did Daddy's Song, and they did Listen to the Band, and when it went into the organ break, and Listen to the Band, where it kind of drifts off, and these organ chords, that turned into the Porpoise Song, and then they did the Porpoise Song, and that finished and went back into Listen to the Band.
Oh, wow.
So that was really good.
That sounds amazing. Oh, the Monkees are great, aren't they?
They're fantastic, and they played most of their instruments. They had plenty of time to practice, obviously, but they did touring in the day.
They did.
So, of course, they had to play their own instruments for the touring, so it wasn't as if they were totally inept.
Their very first gig was on December 3rd, 1966, in Honolulu.
Wow.
Because they thought that if they played in Hawaii, nobody would turn up, nobody would know if it was bad. This is a little bit of trivia that I had for you. My friend Jack in LA has watched these episodes today and has been sending me all kinds of amazing knowledge. He's from very near Hollywood, and he grew up sort of when all of these things were being filmed. So he has, like, all of the stories. He's a great guy. And he told me, and I did not know this, but you know when they're doing the little romp thing and they're going and they're in their little wetsuits and in a fountain and frolicking? The fountain in which they are frolicking is more famously known, not as the Monkees fountain, obviously, but as the Friends fountain.
Wow, okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. That's good. That's a good bit of trivia.
I didn't know that. I was quite surprised at that.
Oh, no one told me life was going to be this way.
No.
Could you imagine the Friends fountain to be in New York? But of course, they filmed in LA, which is why they all had such a hearty tan, which I think New Yorkers tend not to have.
Yes. Quite.
My note on the romp is that, I mean, they get a lot of mileage out of those orange wetsuits in various episodes. They turn up quite a lot. It's very Can't Buy Me Love in places, just the chasing around in high speed. It's almost actionable.
Yeah.
There's certain elements haven't aged very well. There's a Native American hunting sequence where they're hunting a Native American guy with...
Yeah.
They've got guns and he's got a bow and arrow.
That's not what I call great.
No, it's very of the time. I think American culture in the 60s was so Western cowboys and Indians culture.
Mm.
And I think just that sort of TV Hollywood violence, because there's in some of the other episodes there's like allusions to executions and like putting Mexican bandits against the wall and shooting them and guillotines and things like that. It was all part of the romping fun. So sort of, it's a lot more violent than you would get in a kid's show these days, I think. Just the allusions to, like, killing and violence and shooting and that sort of stuff.
That's right. It was all in good fun.
It's all in good fun, yeah. I think there was a lot more separation in people's minds back then between reality and fiction, if that makes sense, where I think now we're a bit more conscious how these ideas aren't totally remote from each other, that actually does reflect and have repercussions out into the real world a bit, or to, you know, to however many degrees,
yes, quite,
and that kind of
as,
thing.
As we have seen, to the world's detriment in the news.
I think we have made progress. I think sort of recognising the fact that you make these jokes and these kind of gags and things don't sit in isolation, and it's not just all harmless fun necessarily. Western tropes that were so ingrained in popular culture, a lot of these things just kind of perpetuated certain stereotypes without critiquing them in any way, that kind of thing.
After this whole romping of various levels of appropriateness, we find out that the butler and Kingsley and Madame Roselle were all plotting together.
Pam, pam, pam.
To get Ellie to give the mansion up. And so, obviously, the thing that the monkeys did to just get their own back and stop all this from happening is drug their celebratory wine because, you know, they're teenagers. Mickey's been working on some sleeping tablets. In the earlier episodes of Series 1, there is quite a lot made of Mickey's love of science and chemistry.
Right, okay, so he had a thing.
It was a bit of a thing in the earlier episodes, but it wasn't really expanded upon towards for the rest of the series and into the second series. And I feel like it could have been, like, a really proper good thing. It could have been worked into so many more stories.
Yeah, giving him an extra thing and get kids interested in science and inventing and that sort of stuff as well.
I think so, because Mickey is a very intelligent man, and he's always been into science and that kind of stuff. It would have been a nice sort of link from fictional Mickey to real Mickey. He's been working on some sleeping tablets because obviously that's what he'd do. It just so happens that he brought his experiment with him to this place to pick up an organ that he'd inherited. Davy disguises himself as a knight. This sounds like I'm making it up as I'm going along.
which is no more than they did.
Literally. Davy disguises himself as a knight, puts some sleeping tablets into the celebratory wine, and then they all fall asleep very, very quickly, but only when Peter threatens them with a finger gun, and every time he pretends to shoot at them, they collapse.
Shall I tell you briefly my Mickey Dolenz anecdote?
Yes, please.
Growing up in rural Lincolnshire in the 80s, I was far away from anything related to showbiz. I didn't live in London, so there was no chance of ever meeting or even seeing celebrities out and about. And I was only back then, music-wise, into the Beatles and the Monkees, possibly the Moody Blues at that stage as well, but the main ones would have been the Beatles and the Monkees. They were my guys. We used to go swimming in Newark in Nottinghamshire, which is a little market town. We'd go there every Saturday swimming, and then sometimes we'd look around Newark afterwards and just roam around the shops. One day we were out in the shops, walking around in the high street, and my mum said, "Oh, look, there's Mickey from the Monkees." I was like, "What?" She's like, "There, look, it's Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees." It's like, where? Look, no, there, look, there he is. Oh, he's gone. And this was at a time, it turns out, he used to live near Newark. He had a little mansion up there. He lived out in the countryside. But it was a bit mind-blowing. Like, I had no idea that that there was any chance of meeting one of my eight musical heroes at the time. Just happened to be wandering past in this grotty little Nottinghamshire market town.
Oh, wow.
So it was really surreal, and I didn't see him.
Oh.
It's just my mum saying, "No, there he is." And I'm like, "What? Where?"
No.
That's my Mickey Dolenz non-encounter.
That's a great anecdote.
Thank you.
So the next one is Captain Crocodile, which is my very favourite Monkees episode.
Your very favourite one?
My very favourite.
Oh, that's good. I like this one a lot more.
Good.
Because this one is actually about them as a band. It felt a bit less contrived as well. I don't want to criticise something that's working for its core audience, but the idea of going to a haunted house to get an inheritance and stuff, it's a fairly standard setup for romps and that kind of thing, but this is more about the TV industry at the time and entertainment and that kind of things. So it's a bit more pointed in a very harmless and lightweight way.
Mm.
So this is Captain Crocodile, which is a very transparent send-up of Captain Kangaroo, which I know almost nothing about at all. It's one of those American TV institutions that never made it over here. I only know it from one of the songs on the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, Flowers on the Wall by the Statler Brothers mentions smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. And that's really my only reference point for Captain Kangaroo at all.
I've actually never heard of it, so you have way more knowledge than I have.
So it's a guy called Bob Keeshan. I think, I don't have this confirmed, this was just the impression I got from watching it, that possibly Krusty the Clown was maybe also based on Captain Kangaroo, because it's a very similar idea of this kid's entertainer who on screen is very wacky and then off screen is quite embittered and paranoid.
Yeah, I can imagine it.
It's the longest running kid show ever at the time. It ran from the 50s through to the 80s, I think, with the same actor. So it was, yeah, it was a proper massive American institution that just had no impact over here whatsoever. Not, yeah, it wasn't like Sesame Street or the Monkees even. So Captain Crocodile is this aging clown-like character. He's a wacky children's TV presenter. It's like a live show where he just does wacky antics.
Yeah, makes strange noises and whatnot. And the Monkees have somehow got a slot on that show, which is evidently very, very popular.
But this makes him very insecure. I don't think it's really explained why, but I think he's just aging and feels like he's going to get put out to pasture soon. So he feels very jealous and insecure around the Monkees, and he gets very, very paranoid. So he does everything he can to sabotage their appearances whenever they're on TV with him. That is essentially the setup. They get sent a telegram. The secretary asks, "May I see the wire?" So we have the "May I see the wire" gag where Peter pulls a coil of wire out of his jacket. That entertained me. It's very silly, but that was a very Chico Marx kind of gag.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like John Lennon said, the Monkees are nothing like the Beatles, the Monkees are like the Marx Brothers, and there is just so much Marx Brothers-style content in these episodes.
You sing a high, eh?
Yes, I have a falsetto voice.
That's a funny. My last pupil, she got a false set of teeth.
So they go in and they see Junior, and he wants them to be on the show. They don't want to be on the show, so he decides that he's going to get the president of the network involved. So he calls his dad.
Yes. They don't want to appear on the show. I mean, they're excited about appearing on the show because they want their big break, but Captain Crocodile won't let them perform, essentially. He just uses them as gags. He puts pies in their faces, but they never get to actually play the music.
Yeah, this one was the original version of Valerie. This particular performance is famous for the curtain that Davy wore. Well, at least it looked like that anyway. It was apparently a shirt, and it most certainly had some sleeves. Also, what's happening in this video is that it's a very weird sort of camera angle, because Davy sort of comes out of the main group of the band, and he's kind of put way more into the foreground, and everybody's put into the background.
Yeah, he's sitting on a riser, I think he's sitting in front of the camera on the camera's big pivot arm. The crane, that's the word for it. He's sitting on the camera crane, I think, in front of the camera, so the camera rises up, but he's in front of the camera, and he appears to be floating up to space, or floating up towards heaven.
Yes. This is specifically to disguise Michael Nesmith's fingers.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because when he was eight, Mike was hit on the hand with a hammer.
Oh, really?
By his friend. They were playing a game, there was an accident, and Mike broke his hand. Because his mother was skint, obviously, at the time, and Americans don't have an NHS, he couldn't get his hand set properly, so the bones never fused back together properly. The doctor said that he was never going to have full functionality in that hand again, and he never did retain it. But the doctor suggested that he learn to play guitar. But he didn't have the dexterity to play that from Valerie.
Yes, it's Louis Shelton as the guitarist.
To disguise Mike's hands, which obviously could not do the thing, there were so many close-ups of diddly 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 bits. Because I know music, I know my technical terms, diddly diddly diddly. So yeah, that's why they have Davy in front of Mike so much.
It's rising up. See, this is the first, after Davy Jones died, this was the first clip I could bring myself to watch of the Monkees. So it's just this clip of Davy kind of floating upwards, and it was just, I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear to watch it was just awful.
Gosh, yeah, no, I can imagine that.
I thought, I'll watch a Monkees clip just to, like, remember Davy by, but I couldn't watch it.
Yeah, I still can't listen to Daydream Believer.
Wow. A while ago, there was a poll of, like Monkees fans' most hated Monkees songs. And I couldn't work out why Valerie was sort of in the top 10 of this poll of most hated Monkees songs.
How could anybody hate this song? It's great.
It makes no sense to me. Like, all the others I could kind of see. Another one will be coming up a bit later. It's a song that I like. But generally, there were songs I could see. Obviously, in there was The Day We Fall in Love, which is the worst song by anyone ever. The worst thing ever perpetrated by a music band.
Yeah, worst song ever.
But Valerie is a very good, straightforward 60s pop song. This is a theory I came up with from watching this. I wonder if people just don't like that guitar part because it's very glaringly not one of the Monkees playing it. I wonder if there's sort of a thing with Monkees fans. It's kind of like looking behind the curtain a bit too much. It's like, oh, that's clearly not Nesmith.
Do you know, I've honestly never heard of anybody saying they don't like Valerie.
So we have a little daydream cutaway here of them imagining all the things they could do with their own TV show. And there's some quite fun things there. I like the gag, will the real Davy Jones please stand up?
I am standing up.
Yes, I love that. And the what's my line? Oh, a Mike being a weatherman.
The orange wetsuits turn up again when they're playing superheroes.
Yes, the Batman spoof is amazing. The day that I watched this the first time, I'd done something naughty, and I don't know what I'd done. It doesn't really matter. My dad had said to me, because I'd been naughty, I wasn't allowed to watch the Monkees when it was on. I'd have to wait because I was taping it. But I snuck upstairs and I watched it on Mum and Dad's television in their bedroom. And I was doing really well at kind of giggling quietly and not making any noise. But the Frogman and Reuben the Tadpole, no. Oh, I screamed. I was just screaming, laughing the whole way through.
It has all like the pow, blam captions, but the one that I laughed at was miss. Cretch?
Cretch?
I remember that, actually. That's the one bit I remember from when I watched it last in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah. It just absolutely killed me every time. It's just the way they come in. Because Mickey and Mike are being the baddies. Neither of them can remember their lines. And they're trying to tell each other what their lines are. And finally, Mike's like, yeah, nobody gonna stab us now. And then Peter and Davy come in and Peter's like, no one except for Frogman. And then Davy goes, I'm Reuben the Tadpole. Reuben the Tadpole. Who calls a tadpole Reuben? Why would you? So yeah, I lost it, and obviously Dad heard me, and he was like, "I thought I told you not to watch the Monkees this morning." I was like, "I'm sorry, I'm paying for it." That is why it's my favourite episode.
Oh, that is a good bit. Yeah, that was particularly good. I think they should just have the whole episode, or an whole episode. Of the Batman spoof.
Yes, I think so. They definitely should have done way more with that. Even if that's just all you see of the Monkees, I feel like that will be enough to kind of give you the idea of what the Monkees is about.
Yeah, and I feel I would like episodes where the Monkees play more of the characters, so it's more of them and less of the bewildered older comedy actors.
Yes.
I think it's similar to my feelings on the film Help. Much as I like Leo McKern and all the others, it's too much. Too much Leo McKern, not enough Beatle.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
I don't need to see these people. I can see them in any other swinging 60s film.
And The Prisoner.
Auntie Griselda, which is another hated Monkees song, which I can understand this one a bit more because Peter's not really singing in key always and it's very, very silly. But I love it.
I love it. It's one of my favourites.
Yeah. It's a rare Peter Tork lead vocal. How can you hate that?
Exactly. I love it when Peter sings. Maybe he's not got the strongest voice in the world, but he's got a lovely voice. One of my very favourite Monkees songs of all time is Come On In.
I don't think I know that one. One of my very favourite Monkees songs of all time is, long title, Do We Have to Do This All Over Again?
Well then.
Do I have to do this all over again?
Do you?
It'd be handy if I knew if I could remember the title.
Well, pretty much Peter fans.
Yeah, we're on Team Peter here.
I was very lucky to get to see Peter Tork at Cavern. Peter Tork and the Shoe Suede Blues.
Nice. Did you meet him?
I did.
Heather, friend of the stars, Wainwright?
I certainly did. And I had a hug.
Of course.
And he laughed at me.
Aww.
I was so excited. And you know what I'm like? When I get really excited about things, I speak so fast. And unfortunately, because it was a crowded cavern, he couldn't understand a word that I was saying. And he was like, I really don't know what you're saying to me. And then he went, can you talk really broad American like this? And I said, no, I can't, but I can certainly do a Cockney Mancunian accent like Davy Jones. Fortunately for me, he did laugh. And then I asked for a hug, and he said, you want a hug? A wee cuddle?
Oh, fantastic.
And I went, yeah, please. And he went, of course you can. And he gave me a hug, and I was like, I just hugged Peter Dog and you haven't. And I kind of floated off. and he actually had to say goodbye to me, and I was like, oh, I forgot to say goodbye, sorry, thank you. And and I was really made up, and but then everybody else started asking for hugs because they realised that you can actually just ask for them. During the Anti-Griselda War, they are attacked by the followers of Captain Crocodile.
So that's right.
They are mobbed by a horde of 7-year-olds.
They're menaced by 7-year-olds, and I think this is
which
what
is terrifying.
This is the sequence which really brings home the target audience for the show, I think.
Yes, I think so. And they are vicious children. I mean, you know how I feel about kids at that.
You do have a phobia.
I do.
Yeah, that one I liked more than the first one.
Yeah.
But it's very full on. It's very frantic.
It is completely non-stop.
It's zaniness cubed.
If I made a note of all the lines and all of the moments that made me chuckle, we would be here for another hour and a half.
It left me feeling like I had actually been babysitting 4 hyperactive toddlers and they'd been clambering all over my head.
Yeah, I can understand that. You see, the thing with me and the monkeys, when I first got into them, I grew up in a tiny, horrible little inbred village. I mean, genuinely, in the village that I lived in, everybody's surname was Sutton.
Right. I lived in one of those sorts of villages as well.
Yeah. If you weren't a farmer.
Yeah. Yes.
It was one of those awful, awful places.
Mm.
I didn't really endear myself to anybody simply by existing. And so, you know, growing up was a kind of a weird time for me. So I kind of identified with, I think, probably the target audience originally back in the day. You know,
yeah.
My older sisters, you know, one of them had just got married. The other one was like in her early 20s and was just starting to, you know, like go out with all of her friends and stuff. Mm. And we were all in very, very different places. And so I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. And then all of a sudden the monkeys came along and they didn't fit in anywhere either.
Mm.
And they didn't care.
There you go, your surrogate pals and siblings.
They were. You know, the monkeys are very much a part of who I am. They influence me in everything, things that I like, the way that I do things. The fact that I decided from that moment that I wanted to write comedy. I already knew that I liked writing funny things, but I knew that I wanted to write comedy properly from quite a young age because of the monkeys. They were the ones who made me, you know, want to learn more about comedy history and stuff. And just the fact that even though they didn't fit in, it didn't matter that they didn't fit in because they had each other, and they kind of believed in themselves enough to know that it didn't matter that they didn't fit in with anybody else because they fitted in with themselves and who they were, and they had such a strong self-belief. It really helped me to make sense of who I was and who I am at a very difficult time. Then my bullies, I loved them. They were my friends when I didn't have any. No matter how bad things got, there was always an episode that I could watch that would make me smile. There was always a song that I could listen to that would cheer me up. Just even thinking, you know, what would they say to me if they were here while I was going through whatever it was that you go through when you're a teenager. I used to get skitted because I was into the monkeys. Everybody else was into, you know, whatever was more popular in the late 90s. Like, it just felt like the bullying didn't really matter as much then because I had the monkeys and they were my friends and they were my go-to people. Since discovering the monkeys, loneliness hasn't been a thing because I've always had the monkeys. And it's a really weird but nice thing.
Yeah.
When people say that something's just a television show or something's just a song, it's not, because these are the things that save lives or change them or point them into the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. I think, in inverted commas, entertainment can often be undervalued, particularly sort of in comparison to literature or opera or that kind of thing.
Mm.
But for a lot of people, it is pop bands and TV shows and that kind of thing, which keep them company, and their go-to comfort things is to be like a little bit of solace.
Yes.
And that kind of thing. And I'm sure opera is that for a lot of people, and classic literature and classical music is that for a lot of people as well, but not to undervalue the fact that a lot of middle and lowbrow stuff is also just very comforting for people and gets people through a lot. Even just coming home from a tough day at work, I'm just going to see what's on TV. Oh, it's Would I Lie to You? No, I'm just going to laugh my socks off for half an hour and feel better about the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a really good one.
Yeah, so even if it's not something that you, like, you know, become part of a fandom or, you know, is a regular thing, just being able to just have half an hour of laughing,
yeah,
is just good. It's a good thing.
It really is.
So the third episode we watched was Monkeys in a Ghost Town, which I think,
yes,
of the three is my favourite. It had a guest cast of three, which was a relief after the last one, which was just so full on. This was a much quieter and more sedate episode. I mean, this is the Monkeys, so that's all relative. But of the three of them, this is the calmest. We've all had lots of sweets. We've burnt off our sugar rush and our hyperactivity, and we're on a bit of a calm down now, so this is much more in that sort of zone. But all three guest cast are really, really strong. They're all really good, well-known actors.
Yes, Lon Chaney Jr., obviously son of Lon Chaney, Man of a Thousand Faces.
Mm-hmm.
Lon Chaney Jr. was the original Wolfman.
Of course, yes.
In 1941, which also co-starred Bela Lugosi, who is one of my heroes, as you know. So, yeah, Lon Chaney, incredible actor with a huge, huge pedigree, and just randomly turns up in an episode of the Monkees.
Yeah, and he actually does acting. Like, most people don't bother to act in the Monkees. They do.
No.
They can do zany and goofy. Most of the guest actors do goofy. But he does acting.
Hey, look, what do you want?
What do I want? I want what any man wants. I want a job and security and a home. Yeah, and PTA meetings and cookouts on weekends. That's what I want. Can you give me all of that?
Well, no.
Then shut up!
He plays the role of Lenny with a lot of heart. Very sweet.
One of my notes is that American TV of this time were utterly obsessed with George and Lenny from of Mice and Men.
Yes.
They were consumed by these two characters. They turned up in so many Hanna-Barbera animations. And you'd see like versions of these characters, usually just called George and Lenny. This will bring me my second opportunity to do my impersonation of Dark Age George.
That was beautiful.
But yes, these are these two characters, although they're gangsters rather than grifters or down-and-out people looking for work, they're still called George and Lenny. So Lon Chaney Jr. plays the big dumb one, who's very charmingly dumb. For me personally, a lot of the gags don't really make me laugh particularly, I'm ashamed to say. But in the case of Lenny, I did actually like the gags that he had, and I think maybe just because he was a good actor who played them well and I'm just doing this trashy kids show, so I'm just gonna throw the gags and not really put everything into them.
Yeah.
But he's clearly there and he's being professional, he's doing a really good job, so a lot of his gags actually do land. And George, the other gangster, his partner, is played by Len Lesser, who isn't a familiar name, but he was a big star, particularly in the 90s, because he played Uncle Leo in Seinfeld. So the story of this one is they are on their way somewhere. I can't remember where. It doesn't really matter too much. It's a Monkees episode. The plots are never important. It's probably to a gig or something like that. And they end up in a ghost town, a proper old timey western ghost town. It has a slight Twilight Zone feel. This is often the premise for early Twilight Zone episodes. They will end up in a ghost town and strange things will happen. And so it's quite nice and quiet. And I'm thinking at this point, oh, can it just be the four Monkees in this one, please? As I said, I did end up liking the three guest casts, but at that point, just be a bit more intimate.
Just sitting in a car.
Yeah. Just chatting, please. Have a nice conversation.
Yeah, just not doing it. Just chilling. They run out of petrol and they just wait for the AA.
So they end up in this old Western-style ghost town, but it's not uninhabited. There are two gangsters hiding out there. Some reason, they're 1930s Chicago gangsters, but we won't worry too much about that. We're in pastiche land.
And they are just waiting for the big man to turn up and give them their cut. These guys capture Mickey and Davey and put them in the conveniently located prison.
Yes.
And Mickey and Peter realise that they've been captured. And so they think that the only way to get Davey and Mike is by pretending to be the big man. So, obviously, this gives Mickey license to do his James Cagney.
Of course. It's very high-pitched James Cagney.
Who are you?
That's Rich. Bright boy wants to know who I am. I like that. It shows he's a bright boy.
You ain't the big man. They don't come no bigger.
This episode, I think, in particular, was very deconstructionist, just to be pretentious for a while.
Check you out.
So there's lots of occurrences of Mickey talking directly to camera and breaking the fourth wall.
There's a lot of that.
And then we had the caption, "Stay tuned for Mickey's next idea."
Yeah.
And I can see why it would really appeal to younger people, when I would imagine American TV at the time would be very, very formal.
Yes.
And even the comedy shows would be very formal and formalised and a bit starchy and that sort of...
Yeah, there was a lot of that, a lot of that. There was no fourth wall breaking, I don't think. I mean, I'm not an American comedy expert by any stretch of the imagination.
I mean, you got I Love Lucy, which was very... She's a very big personality, but I think even something as kind of ceiling-breaking as that would still be filmed in a very formal way and structured in a very formal way. So you'd get a big character like Lucille Ball who would just come out of the screen, but even she would have to be in this, just in this one set, and it's four cameras and live studio audience and that kind of thing. But I imagine most of them were a lot more old-fashioned and, you know, double-breasted suits and hair in curlers and that kind of domestic sitcom. And charming stuff. I used to really like Dream of Jeannie and the other one, Bewitched, and those. So there's lots of entertainment to be had, but I can see that sort of like the younger people, where the parents would be watching those sorts of shows, the parents would be watching Lucy and the kids would be watching this thing where just they're unscrewing television in front of their eyes, essentially. They're dismantling the whole construct of television, and one of them's talking directly to the audience, and there's captions that are just to do with what's going on and that sort of thing, and the whole thing's...
Yeah, at the time it was like nothing that had ever been shown before. It was such a revolutionary thing, and it doesn't really look it now. You know, it just looks like your standard 60s TV show. But it really wasn't. It really, really wasn't. It was just groundbreaking at the time, yeah.
It also made me kind of realise that Head isn't in isolation, that a lot of what happens in Head is converting a daft sitcom into a disturbing and nightmarish art film, but using a lot of the same techniques. I may be overstating how disturbing and nightmarish it is, but it's certainly dark and it's unsettling, but it's using those zany daft techniques with random captions and deconstructing things, dismantling things, but doing it in a way that's a bit more unnerving and artsy. But it's cut from the same cloth.
They get caught trying to escape, and George is all, you just wait till the big man gets here. He's going to sort you out good and proper.
They're threatened with execution throughout. And yeah, like I was saying before, this sort of it's quite a violent idea for for a zany kid show.
Everybody talks about it like it's quite all right. And then the big man turns up, and it's actually Rosemary.
It's Rosemary, yeah. Rosemary, bam! Can't you see, bam?
Rosemary, come and see. Rosemary.
Quite that Rosemary. Yeah. Trying to make it all the way from A, B, C, D, etc.
Yes.
She appears in another episode in series one called Monkey Mother, and she moves into the pad and lets the monkey stay with her. There's a moment in that which, even though I first saw that episode when I was 12 and I am now 37, it still makes me cry every time I see it.
Oh, I know the scene you mean, yes.
Yeah, it gets me every single time.
Yes, she's really good in that, isn't she?
She's amazing. I love Rosemary.
Some people don't make friends so easily. Now me, I knew everybody in the neighborhood. Hello, Linda. Hi, hello. I'd call up from the window when I came home from shopping. That was the neighborhood. You'd call up from the street.
So why'd you move?
Nobody called back.
I would have called back Millie.
You're a good boy, Davey.
I watched the Dick Van Dyke Show, all five series of it, and I pretty much only watched it for her because she's incredible. She's an amazing comedy actress. Her sense of timing is absolutely impeccable. And you don't really get to see it as much as you should probably in Monkeys in a Ghost Town, but her singing's great. She's got an amazing voice, which she obviously doesn't play to in the episode. She's incredible, and the character that she plays in the Dick Van Dyke Show is just so inspirational to me as an older single comedy writer woman. I just, if anybody, any of our British listeners ever get to see it, just do, because it's an amazing show. It's an amazing show. Lenny says to her, "You ain't the big man." And she says, "Nah, I'm the big woman, the big man's wife." And George says, "Well, what happened to your husband?" And she goes, "He got too big. Now I'm the big man." And I'm like, yes! Yes, Rosemary!
Girl power!
Him, don't you let these men go around getting too big. You show them who's the big man. Yes, so she's the big man. Or as she used to be known, in certain circles, Bessie Kowalski.
She's an old-timey vaudeville performer.
And as soon as she finds out that the Monkees are a band, she starts mellowing a little, shall we say. Bessie and the Monkees start singing songs together, which is beautiful.
Mike Nesmith playing piano, which you don't see very often. That's normally Peter's job.
Everybody loves my baby, but my baby don't love nobody but me. Nobody but me.
Well, that's okay, Bessie. We'll try something a little more up.
Oh, good idea. Yeah, good idea. Hi, neighbor. Hi, neighbor. What do you know? And what do you say? Hi, neighbor. Hi, neighbor. Throw all your troubles away.
During all of these sing-alongs, and while Dave is trying to form some kind of an escape, Lenny falls in love with the big man, and it's a beautiful time.
He's a very likeable villain, isn't he, is Lenny?
He really is. We love Lenny. It is the quietest episode of the three that we watched.
Yes.
By miles.
It is. It's still a bit zany, and there's a big shootout, so it's not
there
that quiet.
There is a big shootout at the end.
It's sedate-ish.
And they do all kinds of gags in between times, like Peter saying, "Oh, we shouldn't be behind the bar, we're too young."
Yes, I quite like that one.
And then they pretend to be moving targets at a fairground. There's an awful lot of improv that goes on, and although the scene does go on for about 922 years, it is a good scene that works well. It was all very funny and very sweet, even though there was an awful lot of death being mentioned.
Yeah, no one actually dies in this.
Gunfighting. Nobody actually dies. It's fine.
Yeah, it's all...
It's all
good, clean fun.
There's a smile on the wind as it touches my face. Sorry.
You wouldn't do this to Barbara Streisand.
You performed a real public service.
Right. They brought me out of retirement.
Out of the three, which was your favourite and least favourite episodes?
My least favourite was the first one, Monkey See, Monkey Die, just because the setup was just a bit contrived. Had some good gags, but it was a bit daft. And my favourite one, as I think you'll guess, was the last one, Monkeys in a Ghost Town.
Yes.
Just because it was less zany and had a really good quality guest cast, and it was just confined to the seven of them, so it wasn't lots of screaming kids running about or other sort of things going on.
None of that.
And no Davy Jones love interest this time.
No, absolutely not. And which were your favourite and least favourite characters?
If we're talking about monkeys, Mike.
Yeah.
But I think it wouldn't be fair to choose a monkey. So I'm going to say Lenny.
Lenny.
On the strength
Lenny's
of
a good one.
Lenny being great and also being played by Lon Chaney Jr. Just seeing Lon Chaney Jr. in something is good anyway, but the fact he put in the effort to actually act and do a decent job of his comic timing is worth applause anyway. Least favourite character? I mean, just there's lots of interchangeable daft grown-ups and stuff I didn't quite connect with. The monkeys themselves are beyond reproach, but there was just a big kind of wall of these older actors in their 40s.
Yes.
With their Technicolor faces. Yeah, they were what the monkeys were playing against, but that was the part that felt more old-fashioned. The monkeys themselves and their stuff felt a bit fresher, I think.
I would agree with that as well. What was your favourite either element of the show or specific scene?
I think my favourite element is merely the fact that one of my favourite bands has their own sitcom.
That's quite cool, to be fair.
Yeah, even though it's actually the reverse of that in reality. Yes. But
one of your favourite sitcoms has its own band.
No, it's not that.
No, wait.
No, certainly not that.
Hang on.
But as somebody who's sort of coming to it more from the music angle, it's like, oh yeah, there's also... they're in this TV show.
It's like having 58 tiny Hard Days Nights.
Yeah, and probably my least favourite element is just the unrelenting zaniness of it.
There is a lot of zany.
I think I like a slightly slyer sense of humour, maybe, or just, I don't know, it's difficult to put my finger on, really. And I did laugh at some of it. And I think also that sort of 60s American sitcom thing of just having a laugh track that laughs at everything, even things that aren't supposed to be a joke.
Yeah,
just every beat gets a laugh, just somebody just doing an eye roll gets a laugh, or shrugging gets a laugh, or that kind of thing. So that I found that quite off-putting. They didn't have the subtlety of actually just laughing at or putting the laugh track to the jokes.
Yeah, in series two the laugh track gets ousted, so there's that doesn't sort of...
oh okay, oh it. That'll be interesting.
And so I don't need to ask you if you're going to if you'd ever watch any more, because you've got to.
I've got to. We're doing series two at some point.
So tough. In your face.
I will reserve judgment until we watch series two. I don't know if I would watch series one again, other than just watching something with the monkeys in.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things, if it didn't have the monkeys in, I wouldn't watch it. So like A Hard Day's Night is a really good film, and if I wasn't interested in the Beatles, it would still be a really good film.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Whereas the monkeys, I think, the only interest for me is the monkeys.
I think you probably have most enjoyed Monkeys on Tour, the Monkeys on Tour episode.
I know that one really well, actually, because I used to, when it was shown again in the 90s, I used to just record the musical sequences, because I just collected musical sequences of my favourite bands on video back then anyway.
Yeah.
So I didn't record the whole episodes, I just recorded the musical sequences, but that's one where I kept the entire episodes, because it was about the band.
Yeah.
So I know that one quite well, but I would definitely be up for watching that one again.
Well, that's good. Fantastic. So yeah, that's that. Well, thank you very, very much for allowing me to ramble incessantly about
about
the four biggest loves of my life. It has been a joy, to be honest, to be able to chat about them with you.
Excellent.
And thank you as well, everybody who has listened. Thank you very much for putting up with this. It's been an awful lot of fawning from me. We will be back again next week with one of Adam's choices. Would you like to give a little clue as to what we might be looking forward to next week, Adam? Dirty old man. If you would like to get in touch with us, then you are always more than welcome to. You can follow us on Twitter. We are @retro_tube. Or you can send us an email if you like. We've had a couple of really nice emails lately, so thank you very much to people who have been sending those in. Our email address is retrotubepodcast@gmail.com. So that is all from me. What's your final word on the subject, Mr. Leslie?
Play, Magic Fingers!
Yeah!
Oh, pick it, loser!